Hi, I'm Dr. Akiva Down.
And I'm Rabbi Avi Green.
And welcome to Interesting Questions.
In this podcast, we'll be addressing issues that are philosophical, religious, and psychological in nature.
We will be focusing on that which is considered to be controversial, and there may not be a right or wrong answer. So we are hoping that our discussions will yield more questions for your Shabbos table.
Shavua Tov, and welcome back to Interesting Questions. We are on the fifth perek, and today we are going to do Mishnah Chaf Bet 22. Kol mi sheyesh biyado shlosha dvarim halalu, any person who has these three things or these three traits, hu mitalmidav shel Avraham Avinu, he is among the disciples of Avraham, our ancestor. Ushlosha dvarim acherim, hu mitalmidav shel Bilam Harasha, and if you have these three other things, then you are of the students of Bilam the wicked. What are they? Ayin tova veruach nemucha venefesh shvala. Those who have a good eye and a humble spirit and a meek soul, Tamidav shel Avraham Avinu. Those are the disciples of Avraham, our forefather. Ayin ra'a veruach gvoha venefesh rechava, Tamidav shel Bilam Harasha. So those who have an evil eye, those who are arrogant, and those who have a greedy soul are of the disciples of Bilam the wicked. Ma bein talmidav shel Avraham Avinu the talmidav shel Bilam Harasha. What really separates the students of Avraham from the students of Bilam? Talmidav shel Avraham Avinu ochlin be'olam hazeh v'nochalin ha'olam haba. So the students of Avraham Avinu benefit from their good deeds in this world and inherit the world to come. Shneamar, that it says, l'hanechil o havai yesh v'otzrotehem amalei, to bequeath to those who love me a possession, and their storehouses will fill the world. That is from Proverbs, from Mishlei. Aval tamidav shel Bilam harasha yorshin gehenom. However, the disciples, the students of Bilam the wicked, inherit Gehenom, v'yordin lebe'er shachat, and they descend into the well of destruction. Shneamar, that it says, v'ata Elokim toridim lebe'er shachat, that you, O Hashem, will lower them into the well of destruction. Anshei damim u'mirma lo yechatsu yimehem v'ani eftachbach. These are people of bloodshed and deceit, who shall not live out their days, but as for me, I will trust in you. And that is a quote from Tehillim, from Psalms. So, Akiva, there's a couple of different questions we could start with here, but you mentioned one to me before we started recording, which is?
Well, I think we should talk more about Bilam, because I'm not suggesting that he was not a Rasha. At the same time, the introduction and the information we really mostly get about Bilam is that God spoke to him, which usually is kind of an indication that, especially when it's not fraudulent, usually it's an indication that he's not such a horrible human being. God doesn't really, as far as we know, God doesn't really talk to too many horrible people. You know, I don't think we have many examples of that. And so I guess the second piece would be to that same question is, why is that the opposite of Avraham Avinu?
Okay, so great question. To really understand it, we have to look back at the text. There are certain parallels textually between Avraham and Bilam that puts them as foils for one another. So we start with the fact that Avraham speaks to God and Bilam speaks to God. Even though Bilam lives in a very different time period, Bilam lives in the time period of Moshe. And Avraham sort of is this humble conversationalist with God, whereas Bilam is invited by Balak and his people to speak to God on their behalf. And he says, you wait here the night and let me talk to God. Almost saying like, don't worry, God will talk to me, I'm important enough. But sure enough, God does speak to him, and God tells him not to go with those people. And yet when they come with more money, he says, well, stay the night and let me ask God again. God says, well, if you want to go, you can go, but I can't promise what's going to happen. And so it says the next morning, Bilam got up and he saddled his own donkey. Now that is a phrase that that refers to Avraham as well. For Avraham, it is used as an event that occurs right after he is told to bring Yitzchak as a sacrifice. And Rashi explains that it was a way of showing how ready he was to do the mitzvah. And so here too, Bilam is so ready to go curse the Jews, he's chomping at the bit. He's ready and raring to go, that he goes out and he even loads up his own donkey, even though he's a very wealthy person and would normally have his servant do it. And so then he goes out and he's trying to curse the Jews and he's unable to do it. And so Bilam is this foil of Avraham in that sense, in a literary sense, and therefore, right, if they're going to talk about the merits of Avraham here, they're going to talk about the demerits of Bilam. And I think this is a very typical rabbinic device, right? The rabbis like to take two people and compare them either to the benefit of both or to the benefit of one and the detriment of the other. So we have examples where Avraham has a midrash about him where he's thrown into a fiery furnace and survives. This midrash parallels the story in the book of Daniel, in Daniel, where it tells us that in the text happens to Daniel. And so you're supposed to make that literary connection between the two. Oh, these were both righteous people who survived the fire, right? Or, alternatively, we say, well, this person and this person, right? Yaakov and Esav, opposites, right? Foils of each other. Or Moshe and Korach, opposites of each other, right? One's the good guy, one's the bad guy, one's the hero, and one's the villain. And I think that those are very typical literary methods that the rabbis used to educate and to teach their points. And so it's not surprising that some of our own literature uses the same methodology, same storytelling, whether you're looking at movies, whether you're looking at, top shelf literature or paperback garbage novels. And so I think that's where this idea of Bilam being the villain comes from. He is the foil to Avraham in his actions, and therefore it is easy to say he's the bad guy to Avraham's good guy. The interesting thing to me was this idea of, it tells us the difference between them, right? It tells us that Avraham, and if you're like Avraham, you have an ayin tova, you have a good eye, and we can talk about what that means, because I don't think it's literal. Veruach nemucha, a humble spirit. Venefesh shvala, and a soul that's meek. And if you're like Bilam, you have the opposite. And then it says, what's really the difference between them? And you'd expect it to tell you the difference between them, but really it just tells you the outcome between them. That one ends up in a very good place, and one ends up in a very bad place. So that isn't really the difference between them, right? In other words, that doesn't tell you how do you become more like Avram, or how do you move away from being like Bilam, and why wouldn't it tell you that? Is this something you can choose to have, or is this something that is, nature versus nurture? And so for that, I would sort of turn to you, Akiva, and say, talk to us about nature versus nurture in terms of Ayin Tova, and maybe we need to define what that means. It could mean having a positive outlook on the world. Veruach nemucha, right? A humble spirit, v'nefesh v'ala, a soul that is meek. Are these things that are nature, or are these things that are nurture? Are they things we can learn?
So, when we talk nature versus nurture, we talk about the difference between either genetics versus environment. Well, I will tell you that there is a concept known as epigenetics, which means that your environment affects your genetics. Your environment can lead to certain genes becoming more or less active. There's actually a whole bunch of... So in general, from a genetic standpoint, we don't necessarily utilize and make the same proteins all the time, nor do we utilize the same active DNA pieces all the time. And so when they're not being utilized, they get wound up very tightly and inactive, and then they kind of can get unwound or wound differently to create a different combination when they're being used. And we see this all the time. This is kind of, you may have heard at some point that if we unraveled all of our DNA, it would wrap around the Earth so many times, and that's the whole concept, is that these things are wound very tightly, as well as you may recall from your high school biology that we really have four different pieces that make up our DNA. Well, four different pieces, that's not a lot. And yet, we get so many differences. You know, we've also heard the, oh, well, we're 99% the same as chimpanzees. Well, that 1% clearly makes a bit of a difference. Even amongst the same species, we are very different. And so in other areas where they've done a lot of different twin studies, they can show that there are significant aspects of what can be more of a genetic piece and what can be more of a epigenetic piece. And many times it's also really hard to tell, though. We're really good at certain things. You know, schizophrenia. We'll use that example because I'm a psychiatrist. Schizophrenia is highly genetic. It's about 80-90% heritable in some of our studies.
I'm just going to pause and ask you to define schizophrenia, because I know that sometimes it gets mistaken for multiple personality.
Okay, well, they're completely different.
Right.
Yes. And suffice it to say, schizophrenia, 90-ish percent heritable. That being said, it's not a guarantee, but we see that it's not uncommon. And at the same time, we have something that is major depression, which we all think of as, you know, at least in the medical world, everybody's always, oh, make sure you ask about a family history of major depressive disorder. And we think of that as very heritable. And it's closer to the low 30s heritability. And why do I bring those two up? Because there's such differences that we can tell that in some ways that piece of genetics makes a big difference versus the epigenetics component. And yet at the same time, we know that your environment can affect things like your experiences, how you respond to them, what coping strategies you develop, what resilience you have. And similarly, there's an interplay in all those different things. And the problem is, as we get more and more into it, we realize that it's more and more complicated. And even a statement of something being heritable would suggest, right, Avi, that would say to someone, oh, well, there's genes that make this up. We don't know all of them. So even that challenging statement in and of itself.
Thus brings us back to something like personality, where, because that's what I think of when I think of an Ayin Tova, Ruach, Nemucha, and, well, I don't know about the Nefesh part, but let's say that's personality-based too, at least to a degree, and I would say it is. I think that there are, if we believe that in that sense we are born with some kind of relatively clean slate, where we can learn and develop who we are and who we want to be based off of our experiences, based off of our examples, based off of the life that we live and the life we choose to live, which, even that, you don't get to pick your parents. You don't get to pick how your educators respond to you. You don't get to pick the different challenges that you struggle with sometimes. And that can all impact whether or not some of these things come to play, right? So we can take a child who has a good outlook and gives everybody the benefit of the doubt until they're hurt every time, every single time, for years and years. They're going to become cynical. That's a natural, normal progression, and we can't, we wouldn't say in any way that that was a pathological response. In fact, one would argue, especially if one is a cynic, that perhaps having some cynicism in your life is healthy. At the same time, a humble spirit. Well, you can have someone who time and again is given praise and positive reinforcement and continues to be humble. But I think, and this is why I think it's interesting that they have separated out humility and a meek soul, which, by the way, I kind of have question about the idea of how a meek soul is beneficial, because at least my understanding of meek would suggest that it was not only would not be necessarily a positive attribute, but I don't even know if Avraham Avinu had what we would consider, at least based on my understanding of the word meek, and maybe it's a translation issue. But I think that one can be proud of their accomplishments and still remain humble about their accomplishments, still strive for better, right? And that's one of the things that we know. Some of our greatest chachamim and avot and what have you, we know that they constantly strived for better and better. They didn't ever sit on their laurels. They didn't ever say, "All right, I've done enough. Everything's fine now." And perhaps that's a big difference. Whether that's a nature versus a nurture thing, I don't know, because we could look at Lot, right? We could say, well, Lot mostly was, a huge part of his life was raised at least with Abraham, if not by Abraham. And yet, he is not thought of to be in this same spirit, in this same light. He's certainly not a Rasha, but he's also not someone that we generally think of as someone to emulate. And this is in spite of the fact that he chose to go with Avraham when Avraham left, which is meaningful. So, nature versus nurture. I don't know if I've answered that question at all, but hopefully there's at least some thoughts around that.
And I think you've set us up successfully for our next two Mishnayot, which are also about character traits. So let's look at those. Mishnah Chaf Gimel. Yehuda ben Tema Omer. Yehuda ben Tema says, Heve Az kinamer, v'kal kinesher, ratz katzvi, v'gibur ka'ari, la'asod ritzon avicha shebashamayim. Rabbi Yehuda ben Tema would say, be bold as a leopard, and light as an eagle, and as swift as a deer, and as strong as a lion, to carry out the will of your Father who is in heaven. Chaf Dalet, 24. Hu haya omer, he would also say, Az panim legehenom, uvoshet panim legan Eden. He would also say, a brazen-faced person will go to Gehenna, And a shamefaced person will go to Gan Eden. Yehi ratzon mefanecha Hashem Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoteinu she'benei Beit Hamikdash b'mehirah v'yameinu v'tein chalkeinu b'toratecha. May it be the will of you, Hashem, our God, and God of our ancestors, to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash speedily in our day and make it part of our portion, your Torah. Make part of our portion your Torah, or make Torah part of your portion, our portion. And so this idea of being like a leopard, being like an eagle, being like a deer. I think he's not saying you should dress up in leopard print, but rather the idea of being bold, being strong, and at the same time, the idea that if you are, I don't know that I like the phrase uvoshet panim as being shamefaced, but perhaps, you know, being embarrassed of sin is probably a better way to think of it, right? And that these are the things that push you towards Gan Eden as compared to the opposite. And so I'm wondering if any of these resonate with you, Akiva, in terms of the analogies, or they raise any questions for you.
Well, I think I would say that it definitely fits better than our previous Mishnah, which suggested that one should have a nefesh shefala, because, you know, I just double-checked that I did understand the definition of the word meek, and meek is not something that I would think of as any of these other characteristics. It really is the opposite. And I think that, again, the idea of being humble, of humility, that fits very well with still being bold enough to stand up for what you believe in and willing to fly above and move swiftly and carry yourself with the fortitude and strength to persevere. I think that all fits. And I think that certainly being one who is mindful of and embarrassed by sin and therefore not wanting to commit sin, I think that perfectly fits also. But Avi, I'm still stuck on this meek. Maybe you can give us a better understanding of how that fits in with all of these other characteristics that really do seem to make a good bit of sense when we're describing what someone should be to be an Eved Hashem.
So it's interesting. I did look up the etymology of the word shvela, shafla, and it comes from the idea of a lowland, right, or a coastal plain. And so I think it's talking about not being too haughty of oneself, right? That you are. I think they're looking at meek not as in easily run over, but rather as someone who is as a synonym for humble. And so this idea of being, first of all, being steady, right, is one component, not having high highs and low lows, but being steady and flat as you go in a good way. And I think the other is the idea of that you're not high up on yourself, right? You're not saying, well, this is what I expect because of who I am, but rather I have a realistic sense of who I am and the role I play in the world, and therefore I'm humble. And so to me, this idea of, and yet you can also compare yourself to a lion, a tiger, an eagle. These are some of the more powerful animals in the wild, right? And you should be like them in your desire to learn, in your desire to connect with God, in your desire to do mitzvot and to do the will of Hashem. And that, to me, can be a very powerful message in the sense that suddenly we are empowered to say, you don't have to be meek or humble in terms of mitzvot, maybe in terms of certain personal needs, right? We talked about it in comparison to greed. That's what it's compared to. But here, if it's talking about, nope, I'm doing something that is a mitzvah, I should be strong, I should be powerful in that mitzvah and in pursuing it.
Avi, what you just said kind of brings a little bit back for me, to something that I think is important to maybe kind of both of us question, which is, you know, Avraham Avinu didn't come from nothing. We hear throughout his entire life that he came from a pretty high off place, and he was considered to be well off his entire existence, his entire life. We never hear about Avraham, you know, scrounging for food or begging on the streets, or you know, we never hear that his family, you know, they were beggars, they weren't living on the streets of Ur, they were, you know, well to do. And then he continued to be well to do, and the reason why I'm at where that kind of piece is coming from is, you know, we talk about this idea of this wonderful individual who really separated himself from the world. He was the only one of his time who believed something completely different, and then he created within this amazing different belief system. Nobody else has had it. And from there, we have these huge creations of really, let's say, at least two different magnanimous ideologies. I don't know if that's the right word, but I think it would fit. Getting back to that nature versus nurture question, it does kind of make you wonder, what if Avraham had a different upbringing? What if he didn't grow up seemingly or live his life where he could focus on the things that we know truly matter? But at the same time, the things that we know truly matter, right? So mitzvot and being an Eved Hashem and looking out and Bikur Cholim and having family be the paramount piece and knowing that we have to do for others and be inviting and be welcoming, all these wonderful things that we know about Avraham Avinu, right? And the truth is, we know this about a multitude of our other amazing examples, right? Moshe Rabbeinu, we know that if he had not grown up in the palace of Egypt, and instead grew up living as a slave, he may not have been able to have been such the leader that he was. And so, do we have any examples in our history that we can really talk about where, and I'm not talking about the Nevi'im, because I feel like a lot of times, you know, we've talked about that there are examples of Nevi'im who had horrible aspects to their life, their entire existence, and how unfortunately they, even when they weren't listened to, right, there was a learning piece to that, there was a value to that, but at the same time, they didn't necessarily make us as we have been because of these other people. What does it say about having the ability to, and tying that back into nowadays, basically, Avi, what I'm asking you is, it is very expensive to be a frum Jew. And I think that that's to our detriment in some ways, but in other ways, it's an understanding that one tends to lead to more of the other and vice versa. To help us kind of conceptualize that.
Well, so I'm going to address a couple of things you spoke about. First of all, so when we meet Avraham, He's approximately 70 to 75 years old. So there's a whole, unlike certain other figures in Tanakh, we don't really know a lot from Torah about Avraham's upbringing. That which we think we know, we really learn mostly from Midrash. And I tend to lean more towards Midrash being homiletical stories. In other words, they are lessons that the rabbis wanted to teach us, rather than the idea that these were factual stories about Avraham. Second of all, when we meet him, he seems to be of, I guess I would call him middle class means. It isn't until he goes to Egypt and the Pharaoh takes his wife and then gives her back along with many gifts and many presents that he seems to become extremely wealthy. And yet, I would say that Avraham doesn't seem to want for much, but he also doesn't seem caught up in the wealth, right? At one point he says to Hashem, "You've given me all of these things, but I have no one to pass them on to, and what I really want is an heir." And in fact, he gets two. One that starts Islam and one that continues Judaism. And so this idea of being the father of monotheism is his legacy. And so perhaps it's the idea that what I really want is something that exists past my time, right? Because, you know, we may be able to go back a couple generations to talk about the really wealthy, the Rockefellers or the, you know, the land barons, but nobody knows who the richest guy was in Babylonia. At least you and I don't, I imagine, right? Those names have been lost forever, despite how much money they had. And so the question is, what can you do to have a positive impact on the world? Because I would argue that sometimes those people, with or without money, those stories continue to get told, right? George Washington was not the richest man in the colonies, but the impact he had on the founding of the United States was tremendous. So it wasn't necessarily about wealth. Yes, wealth is a component that helps facilitate things. But at the same time, I don't know that it is what really leaves a mark in the world in comparison to other things.
Well, Avi, I'm not suggesting that wealth is the key. What I'm suggesting, though, is that it seems to be that we don't hear about them coming up from these struggles where they weren't having their basic needs met, other than perhaps, again, the wanting for a legacy, wanting for an heir. And really, even in Mishnah Chaf Bet, right, we say that we'll be bequeathed full storehouses in this world, and yes, in the world to come as well. And I think there's no question about that. I'm not questioning the value of having family and having an heir and having and doing what we can to have a better world, a better spot in the world to come, as well as create a better world. What I'm really kind of wondering about is how approachable and how emulatable are some of these individuals where we're supposed to want to have these character traits, and yet part of the truth is that these character traits, I think we can look at history and say, may not have developed if we hear about Avram starving.
So I think that in many cases, we look at the individuals, and no one individual is going to be a great model for everything. But if you want the model of the person who lost it all and then came out the better end, you might look at Yaakov, right? Yaakov has to run away because his brother wants to kill him. He ends up at his uncle's house with no money and ends up finding two wives, having multiple children, and earning from his uncle a significant amount of wealth through his own ability to work and manipulate the situation in his favor. Right? You could talk about Moshe, who has to run away from being essentially the Pharaoh's child, and goes to a country where he's completely unknown,
and marries the high priest of Midian's daughter.
Yeah,
and therefore has a flock to tend. And Yaakov, as much as he gave up, also went to his...
Well, you didn't let me finish, but also gave it all up to come back and try to free his people. In other words, in the end, right, Moshe has no wealth in his legacy. He has actually really nothing to hand on to his children.
Right, but Avi, the issue that I have is not the fact that these individuals, what they had throughout their entire life. I'm talking about in the beginning where they are developing and learning to understand what matters most, which really is where a lot of these things do take place. I mean, we have, you know, we talk about again, you have to be bold as a leopard, light as an eagle, swift as a deer, strong as a lion, to have a good eye, to have a spirit that's humble. People who have these character traits, I think there is a huge nature component to that. And I think that if we look, nurture component to that. And I think if we look at environment that, and we know this, right? We have countless socioeconomic studies that talk about these demographics where, unfortunately, time and again, we see that those who are have-nots continue to have not. And I don't know that I buy into that it's just because they have chosen to worship in one way or another. I mean,
I'm not sure that's it's suggesting that. In other words, I think that it is not tying these things to physical or material wealth. I think that it is tying these things to something that is of a spiritual nature. And so it's not telling you, while you could read it as be bold in business, it may be just as easily saying be bold in your desire to learn, be bold in your desire to worship God, right? Do so from a position of strength. Do so from a position of hard work.
It has to come from somewhere, though.
Correct.
Right. Those of us who, those who can successfully be in a position to think that Kola will pay their bills and wages, usually have another backer.
So you're correct. I think it comes from two places. One, as you said, there has to be a nurture component. So it has to come from parenting of some sort. Whether that's your natural parents, whether that's adopted parents, whether that is, mentors. And so, to me, that speaks very much about the role that we have a responsibility to play as parents and mentors in our community. Right? We have an obligation to try to make sure that the children in our community learn to do the right thing and have good midot. And on the flip side, I would argue it also goes to the idea of making sure that we provide financially so that the family or the child who can't concentrate because they're hungry, right, won't learn And therefore, we need to find a way to make sure that that isn't the case. We, thank God, have enough resources, at least right now in our communities, to make sure that every child has something to eat, that children who want a Jewish education of some sort have the opportunity to get at least something.
Well, I think this brings us to a good point where we might have to continue this on a Thursday discussion, because I think there's a lot more to be said about whether or not it's too expensive to be a Jew. And I think that this will be something good. Avia, I'm priming us to have this discussion. But I also think it's a good discussion to have around your Shabbos table, because I think that it's something where our children should grow up understanding that you, in order to have the opportunities to have a beautiful Jewish education and to have a wonderful Shabbos table with which to have these amazing conversations, you have to do a little work. You have to do a little avodah. And I think that it's important that we don't forget about that, because it's in some ways a crisis within our people, that you look at the prices in the butcher, or you look at the yeshiva tuition bill, and some people think, which am I going to have, because I can't have both. And I think that it's important that we consider that and that we talk about that as a people, because I will say that there are other organizations and groups out there and religions out there who have chosen differently, and I'm curious if there aren't some things that they maybe haven't gotten a little bit more reasonably. And we'll have to continue that conversation.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to reach us, you can reach us at iqdiscuss@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you and responding.